welcome to Unquestionably Nerdy, the show where we like to talk about everything that makes us want to geek out, freak out, and stop bothering George R.R. Martin over finishing the books. He's got a life, he's got his war figurine to play with, he can do what he wants. I am one of your hosts, Kenna MacArthur, and today I am still by myself. Cole is still dead, not to worry, I'm sure he will return from the dead as a frozen corpse at some point. But while he's gone, I wanted to take this episode to, rather than like last episode where I, you know, talked all about myself and my interest in mythology, I thought I would take this episode to convey the shared opinions of the entire Unquestionably Nerdy team, Cole included, while he's not here to defend himself or tell us that's not true. That opinion being that Game of Thrones is still the best TV show ever. Yes, I know. Put down your torches and pitchforks. Your very on-theme torches and pitchforks. I know. We all know how Game of Thrones left us. We all know the disappointments we faced with season 7 and 8. We all know the critiques. I'm probably not going to say anything new about those seasons or the seasons that came before at any point in this episode. But that's fine, because I said it is. Today in this episode, I'm going to explain why Game of Thrones is still the bestest show ever from my perspective. And by that I mean the shared perspective of myself and Cole, while he's not here to say otherwise. Game of Thrones, since I watched it, has been my favorite TV show ever. And I'm not a person who likes to pick favorites when it comes to, like, TV shows and movies and songs and musicians and whatever, even though our first episode of this podcast ever was an episode about favorites. But generally speaking, I always have the sort of the regular answers I go to for these topics of conversation, but I don't often have a sort of set in stone answer for which is my favorite among like movies and TVs and whatever. Well, I say for television shows, I actually do have a favorite, and that is Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is still my favorite TV show ever. And today I'm going to defend it, and you are at liberty to rage against me and Cole in the comments, because Cole agrees. We've established this. And at no point in any future episode will you ever hear him say otherwise. If he does, that's AI. But I'm going to start off this episode defending my favorite show. Not even defending. Because I recognize the critiques of season 7 and 8. I recognize what the end of the show was. And in light of that, I'm going to open up the episode with just a little bit of discussion on those critiques of 7 and 8, of how the show ended, and honestly pay homage to it, because, like, pay homage to it? Is that the right phrasing? I don't think so. I don't know. English major, coming into work. But I'm going to talk about the season 7 and 8 critiques before I get into what I love about the show, because that's what I want to do, is talk about why I love the show and love the world that George R.R. Martin built, and the, without a doubt, wonderful things that Dave Benioff and D.B. Weiss did with the show as showrunners. I want to talk about why I love the show, but for a topic like Game of Thrones that has been lambasted for its ending, you can't recognize the low point. You can't praise the high points without recognizing the low points. Because my love for this show exists with the show as a whole. None of us can remove the fact that seasons 7 and 8 occurred. So getting into just some of the critiques about season 7 and 8, there are many, like the idea of, like, just from talking about the world of Game of Thrones and the world of Westeros and beyond, this scale is so off, right, Ouija? So much of the last two seasons takes place in Westeros as a whole, in the Seven Kingdoms. In fact, did they go to Essos at any point in season 7 and 8? I don't think so. Not that I can remember. Maybe if I thought about it more, I could remember something, but right now I don't have anything that comes to mind. But the scale of Westeros and the world that we see in season 7 and 8 is so off, and people love to talk about how quickly people can get, the characters can get around in the world, and how they can just teleport from the Arm of Dorne to north of the Wall in a day, right? Makes zero sense. The continent of Westeros is massive, and before, in the series prior, it felt massive. It felt enormous. It felt real. It felt like they had to make their way across a continent to tell the story that they were telling. The time which traveling took made the story feel real, and it also served the story by giving us time with the characters before each meeting between characters that we loved, or before each battle took place, right? And then all of a sudden, Daenerys can get from Dragonstone in the very south of Westeros to north of the Wall in a very vague amount of time, what seems to be like a day, maybe. Certainly soon enough that Jon and Jorah and the rest of the North of the Wall gang in season 7 don't freeze to death sitting still on a small island in tundral conditions. Dany can just like get across the whole of the continent like that, not a problem. Dragons can't fly that fast. It's right, I don't know any dragons personally that you know of, but it's just ridiculously fast, and it takes away from the time with these characters and the threat that distance played in the story as a whole, because you can get anywhere you need to. You can save any ally you need to in no time at all. And that highlights another point, another critique that people have of the last two seasons, is that they, rather than writing moments that come off as, oh my gosh, unpredictable, never expected this, they're so trying to force the unpredictability from the start. I think probably in the last two seasons, the crowning moment of this critique is, I guess I should say at this point, spoilers for Game of Thrones, if you've not watched it. I feel like that should be expected. I feel like that should go unsaid. We're talking about the show as a whole, and I'm talking about critiques of the last two seasons. But there you go. Spoiler alert for Game of Thrones if you haven't seen it. But I feel like the crowning moment, the number one looked at moment, the sort of key example of the show trying to feel unpredictable, is the death of Littlefinger. The death of Littlefinger in the North towards the end of season 7 so wants to be a moment of, oh my gosh, the Stark kids were working together the whole time, even though we thought that Littlefinger was successfully pitting them against each other. And it so doesn't work because we never get to see the discussion between the Stark kids occur, and we have no reason to look back on that, on any of their interactions before the death of Littlefinger, and go, oh, that's when they came together, and that's when they united, and that's when they, you know, started to operate as a team in order to take down Littlefinger, in order to serve the family, right? The pack together survives. And in the moment, like, it feels like such a strong moment when it happens. I remember watching that scene in season 7 when the season 7 was coming out. And I was like, oh my god, they got him, he's dead! One of the biggest pieces of shit in the show is dead! And then we all took time to reflect on it. And it was like, when did they decide to do that? When did they come to terms with the fact that they're all working together? I don't know. None of us know. D.B. Weiss and David Benioff don't know. The Stark kids just needed to come together, and they wanted it to feel unexpected. So they gave you no clue that it was going to happen. Because that's how you write a twist. Another popular critique is that it just, everything is so rushed. Like we kind of talked about it with the scale of Westeros, everything can happen in a moment because you can get anywhere in a moment. But the D.B. Weiss and David Benioff wanted the show to end because if you're unaware, they had a possible job lined up with Star Wars that was apparently greenlit and apparently going to go forward. Well, did not end up happening after Game of Thrones. So all of this poor ending really amounted to nothing. So everything is so compacted. No time is taken with any of the stories in previous Game of Thrones, or even if season 7 and 8 could have been elongated into, you know, running into 9 or 10 seasons, then when Jon Snow and Daenerys Targaryen first meet, there's that sort of standoffish challenge to each other that they don't know if they can really trust each other, and you're the daughter of the Mad King, and you're the king in the north who's trying to steal my northernmost kingdom. And by the end of the season, by the end of, like, episode 5 is when they come back north of, from north of the wall, and Dany saves them from north of the wall. Episode 5 or 6 of that season, they're in love. They're ready to go at it. They're undressing each other with their eyes. And even before that, like, fucking Davos is telling Jon how he noticed you staring at her kind heart. And Jon has to be like, oh, there's no time for that. It's my amazing Jon Snow impression. You're welcome, Kit Harington. But that's just such a moment of where in previous seasons of the show, or if we had allowed the ending of the show to be elongated and to take time with it, that relationship could have had time to build over time, to see how they can come to respect each other. But by it was starting in season 7, episode 2-ish, I think, when Jon first meets Daenerys, and episode 5 or 6 when Dany saves Jon and the others from north of the wall, and they're ready to Dany is ready to stare at half-naked Jon in bed and his washboard abs. They just need Daenerys and Jon to fall in love. They just need it, so that's what's going to happen. That's just what's going to happen. There are more critiques of season 7 and 8, more valid critiques of the show, and we could go into more detail on them. But we've talked a little bit about the critiques now, and I want to shift over into the more positive stuff, the fun stuff, honestly. Well, maybe you have fun talking about the critiques. Maybe you have fun complaining. Plenty of the internet does. I can't blame you. But I want to transition now to what I think is more fun, talking about what I love about the show, what this episode's all about, why Game of Thrones is still amazing, and why we look back on it so fondly before season 7 and 8. And the first little piece I want to talk about in terms of why that is, why we do love this show, is, this is a broad point, but the reality that is granted to us in the show. When we first enter into the world of A Song of Ice and Fire in the show, we first enter into a Game of Thrones in that first episode. Ironically, we are given an example of something that is unexpected or out of the ordinary for this world, that being the White Walkers returning. But very quickly are we shown how this world operates, how it behaves. And as it goes on, we are shown, not only told, but shown, displayed on how this world operates and behaves. And we are able to grow into feeling comfortable in that world and the reflected the elements of the real world that reflects the reflections of medieval times in our own world, our medieval Europe, that are reflected in that real world. We see how the North places such ideals of honor, or holds such ideals of honor, represented by Ned Stark, Eddard Stark. And we get to see the backroom deals and political cutthroatness of King's Landing. And we get to see the characters representing that in Cersei and Jaime. We get to see how wild the world of the Dothraki in Essos is, and how out of place that makes Dany, and how that plays into her story of feeling like she is out of place, she has no solid foot to stand on. and she has to find her footing and, you know, push against the world that she is forced into, this chaotic, lawless world that she is forced into, and take the reins. Ah, reins, horse, Dothraki. She's forced to take the reins and take control. And that plays into her story. This world, this reality feels real because we are shown how it operates. And it feels somewhat relatable to the world we understand because, of course, when George R.R. Martin is writing these stories, he pulls from real history and real cultures, basing the Dothraki on Mongol society in some ways, basing the conflict between the Starks and the Lannisters on the War of the Roses, the Yorks versus the Lancasters in, you know, real-world English history, British history. And we also see unfortunate elements of the world in its sexism and its xenophobia and its lawlessness and the disease and terror and war and violence that are part of it. And we're shown characters that stand out against it and ideals that are held opposed to that awful world, that sort of opposition that creates story in characters like Ned Stark and Jon Snow, in characters like Jon Snow and Robb Stark. These characters behave believably. They grow in, they display who they are or grow into what they want to be. And we can see each change that is made. Ned Stark is set up as our protagonist for this show. You know, we got the big name of Sean Bean playing who we expect to be the protagonist of this show. And he stands out against the dishonor and the lies and the trickery and the deception that this world runs on, the Seven Kingdoms run on. But he doesn't always behave in that way. We get to the point where he's on his last leg and he's been thrown into the dungeons and his best friend, the king, is dead. And he stands so opposed to just telling a lie in order to serve the realm or save his own skin. But when it comes to saving his daughters, he's finally forced to stand out against his own ideals of honor and truth and justice and the American way or the Northern way. And that's believable. We understand why he breaks character, because people break character. This isn't seen as a unrealistic moment or a moment that breaks our immersion with this character, because we know why he's doing it. When we believe him, we know that he's breaking his own rules to save his daughters. Jaime Lannister is an asshole, and we see him as very one note. We see him as the womanizer who's sleeping with his sister. We see him as the douche. The prodigal's perfect golden child of House Lannister. But we slowly grow to see him as more than that. We slowly grow to see him as broken and covering up his own insecurities and his shame with this bravado and this desperation to be seen as a hero and a great knight. And the fact that he is a hero, and he is a hero by behaving in an unheroic way, in breaking his oath and killing the Mad King that he was sworn to protect and sworn to serve. And he didn't even do that because he was one note. He didn't kill the king. He didn't kill the Mad King. He didn't kill Aerys because he wanted to take the throne. He didn't kill Aerys Targaryen because he, you know, was secretly siding with his father the whole time because he's an evil asshole. He did it because he wanted to be a great knight. And he was told to stand by while millions burned. Not millions. Half a million at the time, I think. Half a million people burned in their homes when the Mad King told him to burn them all. We see Jon grow into more of a Stark, more of a leader, more of a great man in how he starts off from this low point of the Bastard of Winterfell, ostracized from his family because of his station as a bastard and wanting to become a hero by joining the honorable rangers of the legendary Watchers on the Wall, the Night's Watch, defending the realms of men. And then he gets there and he is shown how pitiful it is and how it's not what he expected it to be, and everybody lied to him and everybody let him come to the wall. And he doesn't behave in the honorable, oh, I'll make the best of it kind of way. He has to be convinced because he is bitter and he does want to leave and he does want to abandon it to go and fight for his brother. When Robb goes to war and his quote-unquote father is arrested as a traitor, He has to be convinced that he can still be a hero. He has to be convinced that being made into a steward instead of a ranger is okay. He has to be convinced to stay at the wall rather than go and fight for Rob, which we might expect to be the honorable act, the heroic act, by abandoning his vows to go and fight for his brother. He has to be convinced that his vows are important, that honor is important, that truth is important. And that honor that he displays, that honor that he holds so close to his heart, either from his father or the lessons he learned at the wall, comes into play with when he meets the wildlings for the first time, and he sees that the stories about them are not just one note, and that they do need defending, and that they are behaving violently, but for a reasonable means, a reasonable purpose to just survive and get south of the wall before the Night King comes. All of these characters behave believably. They're not... It never feels like they are acting for the sake of a plot or to move the plot forward. It always feels like they are acting how a real people would act in this setting. Honestly, when I was in high school first watching the show, I honestly wanted to be more like John. I feel like John was my favorite character, and I think still is my favorite character in Game of Thrones, because he is so honorable and he has to stand to his ideals, not just of like what is expected, but what is right. Stand opposed not just to what he wants, but what society wants, what the Night's Watch wants, because it's what expected, it's because what they know in fighting wildlings. Just because law and custom say one thing, it doesn't mean that's the morally objectively right thing to do. That inspired me, young high school aged Cadden, to be more honorable, I guess. I'm very knightly if you ever meet me in person. So what else do we want to talk about? What else makes Game of Thrones so great? This is a topic, a perception of Game of Thrones that is not new. It's almost stereotypical to talk about Game of Thrones in this way, to praise Game of Thrones for this, but that is its unpredictability. We just barely grazed the topic earlier, but Game of Thrones kept you on your toes like no other show. There were so many points where you had no idea what was going to happen, or you were sure what was going to happen, and then the rug was pulled right out from under you. We started the first season seeing Sean Bean, seeing this noble leader, seeing this honorable Ned Stark who stands opposed to the political machinations of the rest of the Seven Kingdoms, and we are ready for him to be our protagonist. We are ready for him to fight the good fight against the Lannisters, our obvious antagonists, you know, our surface-level, one-dimensional, evil, power-hungry, money-hungry, whatevers, and Ned is going to go against him. And then he fucking gets his head cut off. No one expected that. No one expected that, because it's Sean Bean, because it's a stereotypical fantasy setup, and Ned's death set up the expectation for the future of the show. The fact that we couldn't know what was going to happen, that we could never stand on solid ground with this plot. Whatever plots or subplots unfolded, we could never know what was going to happen. That same unpredictability would come into play with Ned's son, with Rob, when we think, you know, the honorable son of Ned Stark, the proposed protagonist, or the expected protagonist, the son of Ned comes to avenge his father, ride south with his army of 20,000 northerners, and then shit starts to fall apart. He's got to make sacrifices to, you know, marry the Frey girl in order to get his armies across the Twins. But then he falls in love with somebody else, and we think, oh, well, that's still, like, that's maybe less honorable, but it's more passion-driven, it's love, it's still positive, so everything must work out for Rob, all right? That must be fine. And we think it must be fine because eventually Rob goes back to the Twins and goes back to the Freys and wants to rebuild an alliance, and he's ready to take Casterly Rock from the Lannisters, take their seat of power. And from that point, he's going to beat the Lannisters, he's going to fight them back, he's going to win, he's going to avenge his father, obviously. We all expect it, right? And the Freys accept, and the Freys say, come and marry your uncle to our to one of our daughters, blah, blah. And we expect everything's going to be fine. The celebration goes off. We even get the nice twist that, you know, everybody expects the Freya girl to be ugly. But, oh, she's actually pretty and fucking Edmure is actually happy to marry her. Great. Love that. This is all turning out great. And then the Red Wedding happens. And fucking Rob's wife and unborn child are taken away from him. Rob himself is shot by crossbow bolts and has his stomach opened. Catelyn has her throat cut and Rob's head is cut off and blah blah. A million things go wrong and everything is terrible and we continue on in this pattern of we can't expect anything. You know, what else could we not predict? We see the setup of when Theon is captured by the Boltons after taking Winterfell, after having betrayed Rob and the Starks. But we see, oh, he's seen the error of his ways, and he's let out by this stranger who is, you know, apparently a servant in the dungeons, and he lets, you know, this mysterious servant lets Theon out, and he's like, he's expressing to this servant, like, how much he regrets turning against Rob, and how much he's always felt like an outsider. Very much setting up the expectation that Theon is going to go back to the Starks and he's learned the error of his ways and he's gonna apologize and he's gonna come back and get redeemed and be a hero. But nope. The fucking guy lead, the mysterious stranger trying to free Theon was actually Ramsay Snow, eventually Ramsay Bolton or not even in disguise, but just like concealing his identity, and he takes him back to the Dreadfort and thus begins the sickest subplot, the sickest character plot in all of the show, probably, with Theon getting turned into Reek. Again, we are set up with the expectations, these expectations that we come to rely on in other fantasy properties. The noble protagonist leading the charge against the foul and corrupt and dishonorable and deceptive antagonists. Or when that falls through, the son of the honorable protagonist becomes the true protagonist and is going to avenge his father, but then he gets betrayed because he chose more positive, more loving alternatives to the deals he made. And we think that Theon is going to turn a corner and find some redemption, but he's gonna have to wait for that redemption because he's now a prisoner of war and gonna be terribly tortured for a couple seasons. What makes the unpredictability a positive in Game of Thrones in these early seasons is that there was always something behind it. He was showing how foul this world was, or how often honor seems useless, or how we don't always get what we're deserved. And it takes all those expectations and makes them into lessons for the characters, or, you know, what brings these characters low. Where in the later seasons, they just wanted to play into the unpredictability of it. They just wanted you to not know what twists are coming, because that's what people come to Game of Thrones for, and that's what Game of Thrones is known for, right? Doing it because it's popular, not because it's good writing. But it's not just the writing that we love Game of Thrones for. Putting it on a more surface level, not even at a surface level, but it's the action in Game of Thrones. This is a story about war and conflict and what brings it about and how people suffer from it and how people gain from it. Every piece of action mattered, small and large scale. On the small scale, we see Ned fighting Jaime in the streets of King's Landing. Ned trying to find the truth and fight for the truth and maintain his honor is cornered by the Lannisters and is targeted for those honorable actions. Jorah fighting the Blood Rider to defend Dany, to defend Daenerys while she's about to give birth. Jon Snow fighting the Half-Hand in order to gain the trust of Mance Rayder. All of these smaller scale pieces of action are potential turning points for the story. Ned gets stabbed in the leg. Jorah has to defend Daenerys, his queen, in order to protect her and Khal Drogo. John fighting the Half-Hand sets up the trust that he will gain for the free folk, the wildlings, and set up his intentions to fighting for them as well as other men of the realm. But then, of course, we have the large-scale fights. You know, it starts off slow. We don't see any of Whispering Wood when Rob fights Jaime's forces early on. But it really starts off big with the big battles that Game of Thrones is in part known for. It starts with Blackwater and the explosion of the wildfire in Blackwater Bay. And just that moment of the green explosion and the smoke and the fire coming out of the water and blowing up all the ships and knocking Davros off the boat and decimating Stannis' forces, this setup that we expected to be like, oh, Stannis is going to sweep through. He's got the number. He's got the superior tactical mind. And it balances the scales, knocking out so many of his forces, but he has to push through. Then we have the Battle of the Wall. Again, insurmountable odds for the Night's Watch, who we love, and Jon, who we love, versus the wildlings, who we understand and we know why they're fighting the fight that they're fighting. These insurmountable odds and the scythe coming down over the wall to cut through, and Grin leading the defense of the lower gate in the tunnel, shouting out the oath of the Night's Watch as they're about to die. And later on with the Night's Watch and Jon Snow, we have Hardhome, where we really finally get to see the real antagonist, the real, what should have been, the real final villain of the show, the Night King, coming in and just showing off his power. Not only is the snowstorm and the number of wights that come in terrifying, and how they sweep over the wall and crush the gates down, and how they tumble over the cliff's tops, and they are just completely unstoppable. But then once Jon and the rest of the Night's Watch survivors, and wildling survivors who actually escape, manage to get on the boats and get away, and they're pulling back across the water, they see the Night King raising his hands, and the breadth of the enemy they have to face is so immense and just so powerfully reinforces the struggle that they have and the unbeatable threat that they have to stand against, and how important it is that they get the last of the wildlings south of the wall. And it so powerfully not just sets up but reinforces the path that Jon is already on, that our petty squabbles, our petty politics of the southern kingdoms south of the wall don't really matter in comparison to the massive world-ending threat that is beyond the wall to the north, obviously representing climate change and how the petty politics and power grabbing of the real world is nothing in comparison to the world-ending threat of climate change that is going to destroy us all if we don't stand together. But eventually Jon leaves the wall after he's killed and brought back, and he leads the Battle of the Bastards, and it's another example of Jon even having wanted to leave the fight behind. He's forced into doing what's right because that's who he is, and he has to save Rickon, and he has to unite the North against the threat that is coming, and the North will never be safe. The wildlings will never be safe. His family will never be safe if the Boltons are still in charge, because they don't know about the threat to the North, and they can't unite the North to fight against it once it comes. And he's lost so many times, and he's prepared to lose and die again because he has such a small force against the strongest houses in the North. And it's just who Jon is. He's ready to fight, but at this point, he's at a lower point. He's at a defeated point where he's ready to die because he's just so tired of fighting. It's who Jon is, exemplified in this battle, ironically named after him in part. He's so against and so determined not to fight, but he goes against what he wants anyway, and he's ready to push through because that's what's right, that's what he needs to do. And it's not for him, it's for whoever else it needs to be. It's for Rickon, it's for Sansa, it's for the North, it's for the realms. And even looking ahead after season 6, we still have great fights like the wagon train battle when Dany unleashes the Dothraki and Drogon on the Lannister and Tarly forces. And it, you know, say what you will about Dany becoming the Mad Queen at the end of the show, but it at least sets up that she is ready to be a dragon. She is ready to set the world on fire to take back what is hers. Ironically, kind of like what Varys says about Littlefinger, she's ready to burn the whole world down if she can be Queen of the Ashes, kind of thing. Or at least that is what is the intention being set up in the Wagon Train Battle from Dany's perspective, that she casts aside her own safety in order to go out and fight and take back what's hers. And you have Jaime, who is seeing the Mad King to Electric Boogaloo, Fiery Boogaloo. And I love the connections that people draw of, like, how foolish Jaime was, because at the beginning of the show, Robert Baratheon tells the story about the one stupid noble son who thought he could end a war with a single stab of a lance. And Jaime has to take it upon himself to try and stab the Mad Queen in the back like he did her father, even though he's already been told to get back to King's Landing. But he won't abandon his men. And then, of course, we have the Battle of Winterfell in Season 8, which is a great spectacle. I know it's dark. It's hard to see what's going on. That's entirely fair. Ironically, the first time I watched it was on my iPad, like in my dark college dorm room, when I was alone, just laying on my couch, watching it directly in front of my face. So I didn't have any problem watching it. But if you're on a TV, or if it's, if there's any amount of light in the room that's not coming from your TV, you can't see shit. But fucking Melisandre lighting the trench on fire, the dragon fight above the clouds, still great pieces of spectacle, even if it's very nonsensical and there's so much plot armor going on. And again, they kill off people just for the sake of killing people off. And oh, Jorah has a nice ending. And oh, Theon has a nice ending that plays into their characters very well and their motivations very well. But it's so poorly set up, and they don't have anything to do in those two seasons leading up to that point. But the spectacle is still great. The scale of these battles is still great, and the character of each battle is so great. And like with Blackwater, and like with the Battle for the Wall, and like with the Wagon Train Battle, we don't really want either side to win. We know Stannis is a bit of a bitch, but he's fighting for honorable reasons, and he's got people with him that we like Davros. But we know on the King's Landing side, fucking Sansa's in there, Tyrion's in there, people we like are in there, so we don't want them to lose either. So we cheer when Tyrion gives his speech about, let's go kill them. Those are honorable men knocking at our door. Let's go kill them. And we cheer when that happens. But we also feel pity for Stannis when he's pulled back by his men and he has to retreat in defeat. And then the Battle of the Wall, again, we want the wildlings to get south of the wall because that's the reasonable thing to do. That's the right thing to do, is to get them away from the White Walkers and to get them behind the protection of the wall. That we don't want them to sweep through and kill the Night's Watch, or we don't want them to get south and start raiding villages of the north. It's so strong that we have reasons to cheer for both sides, or fear for both sides. And that brings into another topic, another reason we love the show, and that is the tragedies and victories of the show. Because we like to look at, oh, isn't this tragic? Isn't the Red Wedding terrible? Isn't the death of Ned at the beginning tragic? And isn't everything so terrible and dark? But we also come back because it's not all that. If the show were just loss after loss for the good guys, it wouldn't be fun. People love to point out how Game of Thrones doesn't hold back with the deaths, like Ned and like the Red Wedding and like eventually Jon after he lets the wildlings south of the wall, and you know, all the traitors, you know, for the watch him. And like we said, Season 8 with the Battle of Winterfell had Theon and Jorah, ultimately meaningful but poorly led up to. And so many of these deaths, not like those last two examples, so many of these deaths mean so much to us, and the tragedies give us something to fight for and something to hate the villains for. The villains that take away Ned and Robb and Catelyn and Jon. But when every time Robb won a battle, every time Robb was Every time Rob captured Jaime at the Whispering Wood or was named King in the North. When the Knights of the Vale ride in to save the Battle of the Bastards and Jon and give them a fighting chance that allows them to actually beat Ramsay. Every victory is so much sweeter. We cheer so much louder because we were so broken by the tragedies that happened to these characters, the failures that were forced upon these characters to start. The tragedies are what people advertise because everybody loves, the blood splash and the gore, and people love to talk about, oh, it doesn't hold back. Game of Thrones doesn't hold back. But the victories matter just as much because that's what gives us hope. That's what we want these heroes to achieve. We want Theon to find his redemption. We want Jon to win the Battle of the Bastards. We want Sansa to bring in the Knights of the Vale. We want Ned to, discover the secrets that the Lannisters are hiding. And every time they fail, it gives us more reason to hate the villains. Every time they succeed, it gives us more reason to watch the show and continue to hope that they can win ultimately. We wanted so much for these characters. And ultimately, we wanted more for the show. What I come back to with the end of the show and why people were so upset with it, with how it ended, ultimately, that's a representation of how much people did love the show, is that we wanted it to be better than it was. Season 7 and 8, like we said, were victims of poor management by HBO and Benioff and Weiss. The finale was such an event, and the backlash was so great because we all love Game of Thrones and the world it exists in and the characters and performances come out of it. That love is what made the ultimate failure kind of tragic. It's almost the reverse of what we were saying with the dichotomy of tragedies and victories. The tragedies that the characters suffered in story made it such a strong setup for us wanting them to succeed eventually. But all the success that the show had and what made it, all of the things that made us love the show, made it so much more of a tragedy when eventually it ended in an unsatisfactory manner. But it's that love that made the show mean so much. It's the great writing and great performances and great music and great action. I didn't even mention the music. How could I not have mentioned the music and all the great character themes, all the great main theme that they carry on into House of the Dragon? All those great things are why we were still excited about shows like How to Train Your Dragon, House of the Dragon. Yeah, very different spinoff. But it's why we were excited for House of the Dragon. It's why we were excited for A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. It's why we're entertained by the idea of what spinoffs could HBO make of Game of Thrones. That being said, say what you will about franchise culture that is so prominent nowadays and nobody can come up with an original fucking story now. But at least if you're gonna make a franchise out of any world, at least it's a world like the world of A Song of Ice and Fire that is so packed with history and story and great characters and evocative lessons to be learned and characters to love. If you're gonna franchise out and pull stories from any world, it might as well be this one, because it is a world we love. Have I said anything new? Have I said anything you haven't heard before? I doubt it. You've watched YouTube channels and you've listened to podcasts with all these points before. You've thought these points yourself before, I'm sure. But I wanted to say it too. Cole isn't back yet. Cole can't tell me not to. And he wouldn't, because this is his favorite show too. He loves it. He can't say he doesn't. But Game of Thrones is still my favorite show. It's still my favorite piece of television out there because of all the reasons I said before. And I even went back and rewatched a few months ago. And God, it's still amazing rewatching from Ned and to Rob and to Jaime's reveal as a good person and his connection with Brienne and eventually Arya becoming who she is and Sansa growing into her own strength. And I could go on. You all know about this. You've all seen the show. Presumably, if you haven't, I don't know what you're doing here. But I'll leave you with this call to arms. What do you think about Game of Thrones? Do you forgive the ending at all? Or do you I don't want to say hop on the bandwagon because that sounds dismissive of opinions, but do you more side with the viewpoint that the ending ruined the rest of the show for you? Because that is a very popular view. And if that's how you feel, then that's how you feel. And I'm sorry that the ending ruined the show for you. Me personally, and I'm sure plenty of you out there, can look back on the show and still enjoy it and still just stop at the end of season six. Just stop at the end of season six, write your fan fiction, you know. Love Game of Thrones for the reasons you always have. So let me know what you think. Are there any points, any positive points of Game of Thrones that I didn't mention that you would have liked to have looked back on fondly? There are so many, I'm sure that I missed several of them. Tell me what your favorite part about Game of Thrones is. Tell me your favorite plot from Game of Thrones. Tell me your favorite Game of Thrones character. Tell me what you would want to see out of a Game of Thrones spinoff that we haven't heard announced yet. I'll leave you with that. I'll leave you with the love of this show that I hold so dear. And that'll be it for this episode. So, until next time, I've been Cadden MacArthur. You've been a wonderful audience. And don't forget to be unquestionably nerdy. Good night.